This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, good morning and welcome to so many wonderful, familiar faces from previous executive learning seminars. It is a delight to be here. I just want to, as I always do in my first class, just reintroduce myself. My name is Alex Israel, and I have a number of hats here at Pardes. I run the community education program, and if I can report something exciting from the community education program, it is that we had last year, as well as all our morning events, over 40 evening events, with anything ranging from 50 to 250 people at every single one of them, which is a huge expansion for Pardes in terms of what we've been offering. So that's really exciting. The other thing that I'm doing is running the summer program. And I'm delighted to tell you that we have 100 people on our July program and another 50 on our August program. So that's also an expansion for us. And it's I watch the applications coming in. And I'll be honest, sometimes I even start getting a bit choked up because you look at what people are coming to do here. And people are really on a journey of exploration. And they're coming here to, they're really every single person on a Jewish journey in all different directions, up, down, sideways, I don't know what Jewish journey, but it's really amazing to see how people are coming here with a thirst to explore and discover and take further steps on their Jewish journey in learning and in personal discovery. And the third hat that I wear here at Pardes is a teacher, and that's really what I love doing. The fourth hat is just recently taken on Elmad, which is I'll be the educational director for the online platform here with all of our podcasts and our written classes and our video classes. So that's a very exciting thing, and I'm looking forward to trying to see how we can take that onwards and upwards. So really a lot going on here, and delighted for you to come to the mothership. Not experience things remotely, but to really experience things here. And now, without further ado, we're going to get into our topic, which is an overview of Ezra and Nehemiah. I am very humbled by this task that I have taken on, because usually I do a course of Ezra and Nehemiah, which is something between 10 and 20 classes. And I'm wondering how I'm going to manage to do this today in under 2 hours. But we're going to have a crack at it. We're going to see what we can do. And I'm going to start with introductions. Now, I don't know what you've heard from other teachers and who you've been to before. If anything's repetitive, I assume that's a good thing at this stage, because there's a huge amount of information in Ezra and Nehemiah to absorb. We're absorbing the background to a whole period, and we have to sort of get some of the framework in order to start getting into the questions of the book. So this is where we're going to start. I'm just going to point out this. Has everybody encountered this Cyrus cylinder this morning? Okay, so we already know what that wonderful artifact is. It is actually a remarkable, remarkable artifact, because you have to understand the excitement when the Cyrus cylinder was announced. The Cyrus cylinder, you know, which to a certain degree is the, I don't know, what do you want to call it, ancient Balfour Declaration. It told Jews that they were allowed to reconstitute their country and that they would be able to have their temple rebuilt, and they were allowed to emigrate to the land of Israel, back to the land of Israel, only 50 years after the destruction of the temple. I'll use a timeline in a few minutes. When this was, if you're thinking back to when this is uncovered in the late 1800s, and there was the big question in the air, is the Bible really true? Documentary hypothesis flying through the air. How can we rely on the Bible? And suddenly they uncover a piece of the Bible which is almost verbatim written in the Book of Chronicles and the Book of Ezra. And people like, now they can hold it in their hand. And this was like a bit of the Bible just popping out in reality. By the way, we're very, very used to these things now, because biblical archaeology has advanced in leaps and bounds. I know some of you even toured with me, Ira David, a few years ago. And every once in a while, you see an item on, whether it's on, Haaretz online, or I don't know, whatever you read online, and they'll tell you about a new archaeological discovery. I remember once reading a Lutz Mazar the archaeologist who digs in Ir David, and she was talking about how one day in their archaeology they found a little tin seal, with somebody's name on, and she had to decipher it. Since it was the end of the day and it was very late and everybody gone to sleep at home, her kids were asleep upstairs, and she decided to try and decipher the ancient Hebrew script in this Aramaic, and she worked out the letters and figured out a name, and she says, I don't think that's a name of anybody we know. And she decided to put it into her Tanakh database and see whether the name came up. And sure enough, it was there in the Tanakh. And she said she screamed. She screamed. And she then went to check that all the kids were still awake, were still sleeping. But this idea that the Tanakh pops out at us, you know, and that we can actually see things, this Cyrus cylinder was a remarkable thing. And it gave Jews a hope in so many different ways. We're talking about it was coming up as Zionism was beginning to reform itself. And there are so many different dimensions in which this, you know, this item, this artifact, actually brought up all sorts of, in terms of the historicity of the Bible, in terms of what it meant to suddenly find something which is saying Jews can go back to their land, right? All of this coming together at that period of history was very powerful. Okay, we're going to do a little bit of Persian History 101 just to understand what's going on here. And I want to, we're going to use a little bit of Tanakh and a little bit of historical years. We have in the Persian kings, we can talk about Cyrus. Here, Cyrus actually ruled before this in Persia, but in 539 BCE, he became, the Persian Empire took over the Babylonian Empire and took over all of its lands. And to all effects and purposes, Cyrus becomes the emperor. We then have a king called, or an emperor called Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, who we think is Ahasuerus of the Megillah. I will say this is what the archaeologists and historians say. If you look in the Talmud in Megillah, there'll be a different opinion, where they actually put Ahasuerus over here. It's a bit of a problem because we all know that the Megillah happens in the 12th year of Ahasuerus, but Cambyses, as you see, didn't really rule for 12 years, so it doesn't quite match the Purim story. I think last year we had our summer about Esther. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to leave that for now. And then you have Artaxerxes. You might wonder why I am going into all of this, but it will be quite important to understand the span of history that we're talking about. Is this, I said that this comes from what we know about history, okay? So we can see actually Psukim and Ezra which say exactly this. Well, I'll read it in English maybe. They bribe ministers in order to thwart their plans all the years of King Cyrus, Koresh Melech Paras, Vad Malchus Dariabesh Melech Paras, from Koresh till the time of Darius, and in the time of Ahasuerus, right? Ahasuerus, or maybe as I said, Xerxes, we've got Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes. They drew up an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. Right, an accusation, a sitna. Might that be the decree to kill the Jews? Who knows? And in the time of Artaxerxes, right? What do we have here? We have that the book of Ezra gives us the order of the kings. It misses out Cambyses. Why? I don't know, but that is what we have. That is the order. Okay? So that's what you have in terms of the Persian kings. Okay, moving on. I want to keep going with a sort of timeline just to understand how to... Okay. How to place everything that we're going to talk about today. I hope this isn't... But I'm going to read it through, so don't worry too much. And the most important thing will be the years. Okay? So let's see how we do. We'll start off here with the destruction of the first temple in 586 BCE. The temple is destroyed, and many of the exiles are taken to Babylon. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. Okay? 586 BCE. The Cyrus Declaration is in 538 BCE. Okay? We're talking here, you know, almost 50 years afterwards. Okay? We're all good? So, actually, when we talk about 70 years of exile, right, it's not clear how the 70 years would work. There are actually really only 50 years of exile. I know that Mike was talking about it, but I'll simply say, where do the 70 years come? probably the easiest way to understand it is 70 years from the destruction to the rebuilding. But Jews were allowed to come back after 50 years. Okay? The other possible calculation of the 70 years is from the rise of Babylon until the fall of Babylon. From the rise of, right? Because Babylon came into power 20 years before this. Okay? That's not, I want to just explain to you how things are going to work in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, because we're meant to be doing an overview here. So, destruction of the temple 586 BC, about 50 years later, the Cyrus Declaration, which means Jews are allowed to come back to Jerusalem and the area around Jerusalem, and they're allowed to rebuild the temple. I'll say even more than that. The king offers to pay, to foot the bill. He says, I'll pay for it. It's actually quite remarkable. Let me maybe take a step back and say, different groups had different ways of dealing with vanquished populations. If I take three empires that we encountered, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians. The Assyrians, when they, for example, destroyed Samaria, Shomron, what did they do? They pulverized the population. They moved everybody all around. They did a population transfer. They took the people in Samaria, moved them into five different places, put people from five different places back in Samaria, moved everyone around. They muddled all the ethnic identities, confused everything, so that, you know, basically divide and conquer, right? If you can scatter everybody around and re-move people around, reminds us a bit of what Joseph did in Egypt when he moved people from one side. When you're in a crisis mode, you're worried there might be revolutions. Put people in a new place, they're going to have to survive. They're immigrants. They've got other things to worry about. They've got to put bread on their table. That's the Assyrians. What did the Babylonians do? They always took away the leaders. They left the peasantry in place. They took away the leadership. We find the first Babylonian invasion 11 years before the destruction of the temple. What did they do? They took away 10,000 people, the royal family, the leaders of industry, the leaders of the army. That's another way to deal if you want to conquer someone. The Persians are very interesting. The Persians don't use the stick. They use the carrot. The Persians say, I'll tell you what we'll do. I am the new emperor, says Cyrus. I'm going to allow you all to go home. I'm going to be your, you know, your friend. And I'm going to let you build your temple. And I'm going to pay for it. And now, serve the Persian Empire. Okay? Different methods, but it was very good for the Jews. Okay? Later on, when we meet Nehemiah in a few minutes, Nehemiah was actually appointed for 12 years as the governor of the land of Israel. Okay? It's quite an amazing thing. A foreign governor. Again, I'll talk about it in a minute. Okay. Alright, so the Cyrus Declaration allowed Jews to go back, to be repatriated with their land, and to come and to build their temple. Okay, chapter 2, doing an overview here a little bit. Next, the Jews return. When do they return? We don't know. Probably the next year, 537 BCE. And the very next year after they've come back, they lay the foundation stone of the temple. Okay? Now you say, if they lay the foundation stone, how long should it take in order to build the temple? Not very long, okay? But, have you ever been on a building committee for a Jewish institution, right? So, they started, laying the foundation stone in about 536, but they only really finished in 515. It took about 20 years, right? A whole bunch of things happened in between, which we'll talk about, okay? But essentially, the beginning of Ezra, and by the way, these are chapters in the book of Ezra. So chapter 1 of Ezra tells us about the Cyrus Declaration. Chapter 2, the Jews return. Chapter 3, they lay the foundation stone. And only in chapter 6 will we see the temple is built. It's completed on the third Adar in the sixth year of Darius. The building takes place between 520 and 515 BC. That's the first chunk of the book. Chapter 1 to 6 of Ezra tells the story of that first return until the temple is built. Now you turn the page of a chapter, but you've got to realize that you are going to chapter 7 and you're jumping forward many, many years, because the next story we're going to hear about, that's why I left a couple of empty lines, chapter 7 of Ezra will tell us about Ezra's Aliyah, the man Ezra, Ezra who was a priest, Ezra who was a loyal scholar of the law. But when did he come to the land? In the seventh year of Artaxerxes, and if I work that out according to the years I said before, right, We're talking about 457 BC. In other words, when we say, a lot of people say, who built the second temple? Ezra. Wrong. Okay? It's a great trivia question which everybody gets wrong. Ezra did not build the second temple. The second temple was already built when Ezra came. In fact, Ezra came a good 60 years after the temple had been built. He found Jerusalem in shambles and all sorts of problems. We're going to read about it. Okay? But Ezra comes way after and tries to rehabilitate what is going on in Jerusalem. Okay? This is chapter 7, 8, 9, 10. I'll show you the book in a minute. And then we start the book of Nehemiah. Okay? Again, when does Nehemiah come along? He comes along in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, 13 years after Ezra. Along comes Nehemiah. Now, just to understand this dynamic duo, I will try and explain sort of how they worked. Ezra, as I said, was a priest, and he was a sofer mahir b'torat Hashem. He was a scribe of the, like sort of like a rabbi, a spiritual man. He's always praying. And then you have Nehemiah. Nehemiah works for the government. Okay, in every sense, the opening scene with Nehemiah is when Nehemiah is the cupbearer to the king of Persia, to Artaxerxes himself. And they seem to be on such close terms. When I say the cupbearer, I don't really mean that he only served wine. He wasn't the wine waiter, okay? It seems to become that maybe originally, we remember in the Joseph story, the Sar HaMashkim, right? But it seems to be that eventually became a name for a senior advisor, right? And in name, he was called the Sar HaMashkim, but really, or Rav Shakeh, right? But he was a very close advisor. Whichever way, the king says to him, why are you looking miserable today, Nehemiah? And he says, I just heard about what's going on in Jerusalem. The place is in shambles. It's the place where my family live. It's the place where the graves of my ancestors are. And the king says, what's on your mind, Nehemiah? He says, I want leave to go to Jerusalem. And he gets appointed for 12 years to be the governor of Jerusalem. Remarkable. And that's Nehemiah. By the way, he gets a 12-year appointment in Jerusalem. Then he has to go back to Persia and then makes a later visit, which he also documents. Just to understand a little bit about the difference between Ezra and Nehemiah, Ezra comes to Jerusalem and he hears that there is widespread intermarriage, and it says he fell on his knees and he cried and he tore his clothes and he tore out the hair of his head. Nehemiah comes to Jerusalem on his second visit and he hears people are breaking Shabbat, and he says, you don't come and break Shabbat anymore, and if you do, I'll tear out your hair. Who do you think was more effective? Ezra, who tore out his own hair, or Nehemiah, who threatened other people to tear out their hair? Nehemiah was a man who got things done, okay? Nehemiah was a government man. He was an administrator. Ezra was a spiritual man. Now, by the way, and this is an interesting lesson about many, many different movements, you can be a bureaucrat or you can be a very, a person who gets things done, but you also need a spiritual backing. And it was when Ezra and Nehemiah came together that they made a real difference. But again, I want to stress, they're coming here almost a century after Jews have been able to return, and a good 60, 70, 80 years after the temple's rebuilt. In other words, it takes a long time, right? Things don't happen overnight, and we're very much going to see this question. Do things happen overnight? We're going to talk about this today. But that is what we have here. Okay? So that's in terms of giving you a sort of timeline overview. Okay. And now my third overview before we dive in a little bit. Sorry, wrong direction. I just wanted to give an overview. Not sure why it's cut off over there. Okay. An overview to the book. Okay? This is the book of Ezra. Ezra has 10 chapters. Okay? I'll quickly go through the story we're meant to be doing an overview, and then we'll get into the big questions, okay? I'll tell the story really, really quickly with a summary, all right? I'm happy to send anybody who would like this PowerPoint presentation, okay? We start off in chapter 1, the Cyrus Declaration, and then we see the returnees, 42,300 of them. They set up the foundation stone, and the next three chapters are going to be dedicated to the political struggle of all sorts of other ethnic groups who are in the land at the time, who don't want to see the Jews return and build their temple. So So we're going to see the resistance to that and the political struggle to build the temple. This is all happening at the UN. You know, if we, there's, by the way, so many contemporary reverberations of the Book of Ezra. It's really remarkable how modern history mirrors ancient history. I sometimes think about just so many things, even what I said before when I said I'm thinking about, you know, it took 70, 80 years before they managed to get their state on their feet, and here we are approaching the 70th anniversary of Medina Israel, and there's still lots of rough edges, and there's still things we haven't yet managed to put our hands to. And I say, okay, you know what, I look here, it takes a while. Here also, we've got, they're trying to set up a temple, right? And, you know, I don't know whether you want to talk about now the temple, man, I'm not trying to make direct linear control, but we haven't quite figured out our borders, we have, right? There's a big struggle in international courts, right? Letters going back to the king of Persia saying the Jews are inciting, the Jews are disloyal. You know, if we think arguments between, I don't know, the White House and Jerusalem, it's all there, okay? As I said, that is till the temple is built. And we end that story in chapter 6 with the temple actually being built. Open the story of Ezra. Ezra gets a royal appointment from the Persian king himself. Ezra is even given permission to tax people, to lash people, and even to pronounce the death sentence. Okay? Ezra is given wide-ranging powers. He is seen as a jurist, a legal person, and he's given full legal powers by the king of Persia. Ezra makes Aliyah with a group of about 10,000 people, which is quite remarkable, a whole delegation. And in fact, hopefully we'll get to it, but in case we don't, it's very symbolic what he does. He leaves Persia in the sun just before Pesach. He wants to do another Yetziat Mitzrayim. He wants to do another Exodus. In fact, so much so that they literally cross the river, right? They cross the river as Passover is happening, right? They do this Seder as they're leaving Babylon, a Yetziat Babel instead of a Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Babylon instead of Exodus from Egypt. And it takes a long time to get from Babylon all the way to the land of Israel. When does he want to arrive? The whole group arrive in the month of Av, right? They want to turn back the clock. Av, which is the time when the temple was destroyed, they march into Jerusalem with this new, you know, boost of both energy and population in the month of Av, almost to say we are turning back, we are reworking Jewish history, and we're going to turn back the clock of Av. Remarkable. And the minute he comes, he hears about intermarriage, and in chapter 10 we see Ezra trying to deal with intermarriage. We will see how to deal with that in a few minutes. Okay? As I mentioned, now we enter the book of Nehemiah. Again, Nehemiah hears about Jerusalem. He prays to God and says, I really want to help. He gets a royal commission and arrives in Jerusalem. The next four chapters or so, from chapter 3 to 6 in Nehemiah, are about Nehemiah's mission to build the walls, where he, like this thing here, suffers from a huge amount of political pushback. Okay, that's the best way I can say it. It's more than pushback, as we will see in a few minutes. Okay? And the rest of the book, in many ways, is organizing the Jewish community internally. We have a list of the genealogies of the people. We have a gathering on Rosh Hashanah, where everybody is read the law, and they all burst into tears, and then, you know, they feel they're not keeping it. It's very interesting, Rosh Hashanah, because it mixes an atmosphere of awe and dread. And then they all say, wait, 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 I know this day of awe, but go have a nice Yom Tov meal, right? Go celebrate, it's a Yom Tov, right? Very interesting mix that we have on Rosh Hashanah, on the new year, between the tension that we experience in the synagogue and the fact that it's a festival as well. And then we will see the signing of a treaty that Ezra and Nehemiah put the people through, where the people have to literally sign that they will commit themselves to Jewish law. They make everybody sign off. We're committed to the law. And maybe I'll say something very, very... I'll throw something into the room here, which means if some people sign that they would remain loyal to the law, which meant keeping Shabbat and looking after the temple and not intermarrying, one assumes that some people didn't sign. And this is going to be a major rift point in the nation, where some people are going to be in, and the kosher Jews, and some people are going to be the not-so-kosher Jews, right? That's also something which reminds us of certain divisions in today's society as well. Yes?
There's probably a third group, those that signed and didn't
Yes, and we get, you read about those two, right? Including, let me just say, the high priest family, okay? The high priest family who signed and then didn't do it, okay? So it's even in the best of families, as they say, okay? And all of this, the last chapter is a very exciting chapter about Nehemiah's flash visit to Jerusalem, where he actually finds the Lord, what he achieved, fell apart, or had like sort of fallen apart, and tries to repair things. So this is sort of like an overview of the book. I don't know if anybody has any questions before I run ahead. Okay, I've tried to orient you with a little bit of Persian history, a little bit of a timeline, and a summary of the chapters. And now what I'd like to do is I'd like to address some of the challenges of what's going, some of the five challenges which we're going to face when we look at the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. It's really one book, we call it two. And I'd like to go through these five different challenges which the book tries to address, and we'll see, hopefully we'll have time to deal with all of them. Challenge number one, do we stay or do we return? Okay, the first question is, should we even make Aliyah? Right? Should we go to this God-forsaken territory on the, you know, miles away? Or should we stay in our comfortable communities in Bavel? Second question, I called it, if you build it, okay? Should we build a temple? Even when we're back, building the temple is going to cause a big ruckus. It's going to be a huge project. Is it worthwhile? We've come to live in the land. Maybe we can live without a temple. Or maybe we feel that God is not quite with us. We're going to look at that too. Okay. Challenge number three. As I mentioned before, political resistance. From building the temple to rebuilding the walls. Each time they try to take a step forward in terms of solidifying the institutions of Jerusalem, they encounter political resistance. From who? We'll talk about it in a minute. That's going to be a third challenge. Fourth challenge is simply going to be rebuilding the safety and dignity of Jerusalem. And maybe, let me already stress, you'll notice I keep on talking about Jerusalem. One of the big differences between what we'll call the first Commonwealth or the first Temple period and the second Temple, or let's call it Joshua versus Ezra. You all know the story about Joshua. They went and they conquered the whole land. They settled the whole land. Then we have the period of the judges. About 400 years later, 500 years later, David conquers Jerusalem and makes a capital. But for hundreds of years, they exist without a capital. That was the story in the time of Joshua. That when, you know, after the wilderness years, when we came to the land. In other words, there was the whole land of Israel until we focused in on a center. Period of Ezra is exactly the opposite. They are sent back to Jerusalem. And from Jerusalem there, they had a very small area around. We'll look at the map in a few minutes. And slowly the country grows and grows and grows, simply by virtue of the mass of Jews, the mass of people who identified with the Jewish country. But it was a very, very different dynamic. And that's why the temple is really the hub, and it all flows from that. There's a very beautiful piece by Rav Soloveitchik based on this, but way beyond what I have time to be able to do in this little overview. But it's a very, very interesting dynamic. Okay, if I want to put it in an ideological sense, right? What do you put first? Sort of the land and the civic and whatever it is? Or do you start off with the spiritual hub, the spiritual dynamo, right? Where do you start from? Do you start with Jerusalem? Or do you start with the country, right? If you want another very, very interesting, question about this, these are very big questions about, the building of the Jewish state, right? Could we compromise on a Jerusalem or not, right? Fascinating questions. The challenge here was the safety and dignity of Jerusalem. Can we build the walls of Jerusalem? Can we make Jerusalem a place which isn't just like a blitzed city, but a place of dignity. And we'll see how we face that. And the last challenge, which was a huge one, was religious observance of Jewish law, which manifested itself in many ways. Intermarriage, the temple, and keeping Shabbat, some of the very basic cornerstones of Jewish identity, And that was the things that they were facing in this time. So I think I've outlined the basic questions of the book. All right? So should we go into challenge number one? Okay, and that's where we'll start. All right. It is indeed. Okay? To stay or to go? Jews have... we've always known how to make countries that we... diaspora countries into our own. And to make them into home. And this really begins... I want to stress that even though we said that Babylon was exile... the question is, how much was it exile? Now, instead of blaming all the Jews, I'm going to blame the prophets. Okay? And I want to read you just a passage from Jeremiah. It's up here. Sorry if it's a little small, but I will read a few lines. This is a prophecy from Jeremiah, chapter 29, as the Jews are being exiled from Jerusalem. And this is what he says. And I'll just read the thing. He tells it, it is to... all the people who Nebuchadnezzar are exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon. And this is what he says. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their fruit. Take wives and beget sons and daughters. Take wives to your son and give daughters to your husbands. They may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there in Babylon. Do not decrease. And seek the welfare of the cities which I've exiled you. And pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its prosperity you shall prosper. This is, by the way, where the prayer for the king, the prayer for the queen of England, the prayer for the president comes from. Pray for the country, because when that country has peace, you will have peace. The Jews have always been loyal to the countries they've been in. The prophet told them to do it. And what was the other option? The other option was the Jews would imagine that we are, you know, like, I don't know, if you could imagine that a country ceased to exist, if Britain ceased to exist, there wouldn't be any more Brits, right? There wouldn't be. It could be that once Yerushalayim ceased to exist and Judah ceased to exist, there would be no Jews. Jeremiah's message was a huge one. You can be a Jew in the diaspora. You don't need a land to be a Jew, right? Build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their fruit. And when Babylon's 70 years old, I will take note of you and will fulfill the promise of favor to bring you back to this place. You'll come home one day. Isn't that remarkable? And suddenly we have the idea that we can be a people. How should I say it? It's not a people without a land. It's people with a... yes?
Without a homeland, but a dream to come back and a hope to continue a new Judaism.
Something like that. Okay? Something like that. It's really remarkable. Now, you know, this is a quantum shift after living in the land for 800 years. Since we've become a nation sort of having a land, suddenly our land is taken away from us, and we say, no, we continue the Jewish story. We wouldn't be here today if it wouldn't be for this. It's remarkable. I want to take it even further. This is such a fascinating story. This is a psalm that many of you know. If you don't know it from the Tanakh, you know it from Boney M. Okay? 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 I was thinking of adjusting the translation, which I taught from the JPS, but, you know, because it didn't match the Boney M version. But we'll manage. Okay? We all know this song. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat, as we sat and wept as we thought of Zion. There on the poplars we hung our lyres, for our captors asked us for songs, our tormentors for amusement. Sing us once of the songs of Zion. But they say, how can we sing a song of the Lord on alien soil? Who are these groups who are sitting by the rivers of Babylon, sitting and weeping? Who are they?
The Levites.
So many of people think that these are actually the Levites. Right? And the Levites are coming along with their musical instruments, literally, out of the temple. They are the choir, they are the orchestra, the temple orchestra, the Royal Philharmonic of Jerusalem, okay? And they've been taken as a group to Babylon, and now they've been tormented. And they're saying, sing one of those Zion songs, right? By the way, again, you just to understand the image, you read sometimes about stories of this from the Holocaust, where they would take, you know, a synagogue, and make them sing and make them dance, right? As a sign of humiliation. Now, what do they say? Do they agree to sing?
No.
No, why?
How can you sing the song of the Lord?
Can you sing the song of the Lord on alien soil? We can't pronounce God's name in this alien soil. This land is impure. Even in the halacha later on, they talk about Eretz Ha'amim, foreign soil, as being impure. And they don't feel they can utter God's name and certainly sing the temple songs outside the temple. They're sacred. By the way, again, I think Jeremiah is grappling with these people because Jeremiah has to tell them, build homes. We can't function as Jews. We hang up our harps and we're not going to play and we're not going to sing. Okay? Now, most people just carry on reading, but they don't realize that the next two verses are a complete quantum shift. Because look at the next one. It says like this. If I forget you, Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Okay? Actually, tishkach yamini. I'll talk about this right hand in a minute. Let my tongue skip to my palate if I cease to think of you, or in less correctly if I don't mention you. If I won't keep Jerusalem in memory, even at my happiest hour. Okay, what's this idea? What is he doing with his hand? Why would your right hand wither? And why will your tongue cleave to its palate? If I won't mention you, Jerusalem, at my happiest hour. Yes?
You can't play, you can't sing, you can't...
Right, but the point is like this. By verse 5 and 6, Jews are singing again and playing again. They're actually having happy hours, right? They're saying, suddenly they've accommodated. Verse 1, 2, 3, 4 is telling us, we can't sing. These are the exiles. The next two verses are, I don't know, maybe they've lived there for 10 years. Maybe this is their children. And their children are getting married. And what, you're not going to have a band at the wedding? Now he says, you know, we are going to play. But you know what? When we play, if we don't mention Jerusalem, we're going to break that glass and we're going to say Meshkachech Yerushalayim at our wedding, right? And we're going to play, but we're also going to mention Jerusalem. If I don't mention Jerusalem, let my hand forget what? How to play. And let my tongue stop working. But I am singing now. Understand what I'm saying? I'm singing, but I'm saying, right? I'll sing, but I will remember Jerusalem. The first represents the initial shock. The second represents the accommodation. And just a couple of years ago, we had a exhibit in the Bible Lands Museum which showed that there was a whole shtetl of Jews in Babylon, right? And they had their own laws and their own language and their own dialect as Jews have done in so many different places. Jews really didn't know whether to come back. It was a really hard thing. And that is the first dilemma, right? Should we come back? And here I want you to open the book of Ezra and take a look at the first. You've got it in your booklet, I think. Yeah, you have the book of Ezra here?
Yeah.
And if you look at the first chapter, we'll just look at a couple of verses. Okay. I'm going to start with verse 2. Thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has charged me with building him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Any one of you, all you people, may his God be with him, and let him go to Jerusalem that is in Judah and build the house of the Lord God of Israel, and that God is in Jerusalem. And all that stay behind, whether he may be living, let the people of his place assist him with silver and gold, goods and livestock, besides the freewill offering, the house of God that is in Jerusalem. This is not on the sheet I just gave out, by the way. You've got a handout of the book of Ezra here. I didn't think it was worthwhile reprinting. It's amazing. By the way, again, notice, what do they anticipate? Some people will go. And people who stay, what should they do?
Contribute.
Give donations, right? Right? Donate to the Federation, right? Do the Israel bonds, right?
Right.
How amazing is this? Now, okay, what happens then? Okay, so people go, right? It's amazing. Chapter 2, right? In fact, by the way, they come back. They actually release out of the royal archives the very bowls and the very utensils from the temple, which is just remarkable. Okay, it's written here in verse 9. This is the inventory: 30 gold basins, 1,000 silver basins, 20 knives, 30 gold bowls, whatever. All these different things that are actually what was looted from Jerusalem 50 years before are now given back. Can you imagine the excitement? Can you imagine if now, you know, sometimes when people go, you know, when you ever meet somebody who's connected to the Vatican and you ask them, what do Jews ask you? They always say, where's the menorah? Right? Okay? Where's it hiding? Right? Because we all see it on Titus's arch. We imagine it's still in existence. Right? Of course, the likelihood is it's been melted down long ago, as many of the treasures were from one kingdom to the other. But we're still waiting. Imagine if we got a menorah. Imagine. Would that move us? Would that stir us? Imagine getting those bowls back from the temple. And then we see everybody, the whole list. Look at chapter 2. It's like a whole... These are the people of the promise who came up from among the captives, exiles who King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon and carried into exile, who returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own city. And they tell us the names, Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Reliah, all of these. I don't want to go through the whole list, but you can see it's quite a... It's very interesting, by the way, the list splits into various groups. If you look on page 2 here, right, the first groups are all listed by family. You can see here, sons of Adin, sons of Ater, sons of Bezai, sons of Yorach, all these things. Later on, they're by where they lived, okay? We'll see them based on certain... towns. So, for example, if you look at verse 33, you'll recognize some of the names, right? Sons of Lod, right? And Ono, Jericho, and all those things, right? Later on, they list the Levites and the priests. But I want you to look at verse 64 on page 3 here. See? The sum of the entire community was 42,360. Did you expect, is that a large number or a small number?
Small.
Pretty small. Pretty small. In other words, many, many people didn't come. And why didn't they come? Number one, because they were comfortable. Right? Number two, and here I want to, remember, by the way, I'm sorry about this, we are doing an overview, okay? So, I'm sorry that I'm skipping. Right, it's not the best way to teach, but you will get an idea of the broad themes. So I want you to look at chapter 3, and we're going to look on chapter 3. Let's look at verse 10. It's on page 4 here. They come to Jerusalem, and as I say, they all get together on the Temple Mount to rebuild the temple. And they have the Levites and the priests there and everybody else. And it says, here we go. When the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, priests in their vestments. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? With trumpets and Levites, sons of Asaph, with cymbals. So on the top of page 4, verse 10 in chapter 3. With their vestments, with trumpets and Levites, sons of Asaph, with cymbals, were stationed to give praise to the Lord as the king of it. David of Israel had ordained. What does that mean? As King David? They were probably saying Tehillim. They were probably saying Psalms. So they were using David's texts. It all seems like it used to be. The same vestments, the same big day kuhuna. It's all great. They sang souls extolling and praising the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love for Israel is eternal. I've got to read the Hebrew of 11. Ve'anu bahalel uvehodot la'shem ki tov, ki le'olam chazdo. Right? You know that line. It's halel. Right, that's the line they're quoting. These are all the lines we know. Okay, now let's see what the and it says all the people raised a great shout, extolling God. B'cholam heriu a truah, a shout extolling the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord had been laid. Sounds great, right? Now let's read the next two verses. Many of the priests and Levites and the chiefs of the clans, the old men who had seen the first house, wept loudly at the sight of the founding of this house. Many others shouted joyously at the top of their voices. The people couldn't distinguish the shouts of joy from the people's weeping, for the people raised a great shout, the sound of which could be heard from afar. Some people are celebrating. Other people are crying. Why are they crying?
Remembering the destruction.
So some people are crying because they, you know, very, very interesting why the men who had seen the first house wept loudly. They could be having flashbacks to the destruction. Especially those priests, right? Who knows what they'd seen there. Maybe it was their own parents and grandparents who had been killed at that very site, right? So this is not a happy place for them.
And it could be, there's that saying, you know, like being in the state of Tisha B'Av, Don't be so joyous. How do we know this is going to last? After all, the first temple didn't last, right?
Maybe. Maybe they're very doubtful. And I want to give you a reason why they're doubtful, right? We're going to see it in 2 minutes, right? And the reason why they might be doubtful is because, remember we saw that Nehemiah builds the walls of Jerusalem, right? Even 80 years after these guys return, the walls still aren't built. Imagine a city where the wall, and Nehemiah talks about it, he tries to go around the walls and he says there's so much rubble. Jerusalem at that time looked like, you know, a bomb had hit it. Looked like London after the Blitz. I don't know what to, you know. It looked terrible. There are no walls. If there are no walls, then there's no safety, right? There's no dignity. So you come back to a place which once was a grand royal capital with beautiful, planted, byways and, pools and fountains and what have you. And you come back and the place looks like a mess. And then you build a temple and you say, great, we're back. What is it? Right? Really, what is it? And it's very, very difficult to believe. You need a very, very good imagination. So some people are so excited, we're back, look what we're building. And some people are, disappointed, right? And I tell this, my family story, right? So my grandmother, Aleha Shalom, was a very, very big Zionist, a big Habonimnik, right? And she decided she was coming to Israel, and she was going to make her Aliyah pilot trip and work out which kibbutz she was going to come to. And that was a trip which cured her of all her Zionism. in 1936, she came to the kibbutz and there were no toilets. It was just a hole in the latrine, hole in the floor. And she said, no toilets. Zionism is great, but not without toilets. And she went back to England. That was it. That was the end of her Zionism, right? My grandfather, Aleha Shalom, her husband, actually ended up here in 1946 on a trip to check things out. And through a whole quirk, ended up staying in the King David at the same time that the UN Commission for Partition were in the country. And every night he said, we would sit at the bar and I would say to them, where did you go today? And they'd tell me, and I'd go there the next day, he said. Right? And he toured the whole country then. And during the disengagement from Gaza, when we had pictures on our TV screens of people really being pulled out of their homes, and it doesn't make a difference whether you're right wing or left wing, it was a hard sight. I went to visit my grandfather at the time. He was something like 97, living in Jerusalem. And he saw me and he said, Alex, why are you looking so upset? And I said, well, the news is miserable. And he started talking about his trip in 1946, and I thought he was having a sort of senile moment, right? He says, Alex, when I came to Jerusalem in 1946, people said to me, where are you going to stay? And I said, I'll stay in a hotel. And they said to me, there only is one hotel in Jerusalem. And then I went to Tel Aviv. And they said to me, this is going to be the Jewish commercial capital. And they took me to a place called Dizengoff Square. And over there, I pointed over there. I said, what's that? And they said, that's a wheat field. And I said, a wheat field? He says, I come from London, right? He says, what's a wheat field? This is not going to be a commercial center. And he says, then they took me to Netanya. And they said, this is going to be the Jewish Riviera. And he says, he said to me, I promise you, Alex, all there was on this place was one wooden shack which sold gazoz, soda water. And I thought to myself, how the heck is this going to be the Jewish Riviera? He says, I said to me, Alex, look at it. Look at it now. Look at what we've done. Look at Netanya, look at Tel Aviv, look at Jerusalem, look at the traffic, look what we've built. Looking at these people, when they came back on that day to set the foundation stone, it was like looking at the state of Israel in 1936. What was there here? You had to have a good imagination. Some people were crying, saying, look what we had, and now we don't have. Other people were saying, we're going to do it, right? And I imagine that was a very, very bittersweet, what does it say here, right? The people couldn't distinguish the shouts of joy from the people's weeping. what an interesting occasion. What an interesting dedication. Half the people are crying and half the people are dancing, right? Wow. What a scene. What an amazing, amazing scene. So this is trying, should we come back? Should we stay? These are the questions. This leads me directly into the next question. I'm going to give you a time for Chavruta right now to try and look at a very interesting chapter in the book of Haggai. I was going to start off, but I think I've spoken already enough. Oh, you know what? Don't worry about that. And in the sheet that you were just handed out, sorry, I'm not trying to confuse you with too much paperage, but the first text here is the first chapter of the book of Haggai. Okay? Now, again, I want to... You're all with me?
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the book of Haggai, but I'm going to do it with our timeline. Let's look at the first line together. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month. That's all I need. Okay? What am I saying? They came back in the time of Cyrus. They laid the foundation. The Jews came back. They laid the foundation stone. Right? Who's the king? Still Cyrus. Darius is much later. Okay? Darius. Okay? Okay? Starts ruling in 521. Okay? 521. They came back in 537, 538. They laid that foundation stone. Nothing happened. Okay? Nothing happened. What's going on? Why haven't they built it? And suddenly we see ourselves in the second year of Darius. We have a prophet, Haggai. We don't know what he is. And he starts addressing the people about what's going on. So what I want you to do is I want you to read through the book of Haggai, chapter 1. Okay? Book of Haggai, chapter 1. And I want you to take a look at what's irking the people, what's bothering them, okay? Why aren't they building the temple? How do they feel about their society? And what's the prophet going to be trying to encourage them with? Okay? Just literally a 7-minute chavruta, taking a little look at the first chapter of Haggai, okay? And we'll see what we can do with it. Okay, let's try and regroup. Okay, it has been a good 15 years or so since the returnees have come back. They set the foundation stone and nothing has yet happened. Okay? So, how does the prophet start with the people? What does he say? What do the people say?
It's not time yet.
It's not time yet. Why do you think it's not time yet? Why is it not time?
We're trying to get our act together. We want to panel our houses.
Right. So one of the things is, right? One of the things is that how can we start building a temple? We don't even have homes, right? In fact, the prophet rebukes them. He says, you're saying it's not time, but he says, verse 4, is it a time for you to dwell in your panel houses while this house is lying in ruins? Right? By the way, this is always a dilemma, right? When I live in a yeshuv called Alon Shavut, and when they were building the yeshuv, they insisted that everybody give a whole bunch of money before we even were allowed to build our homes and buy our plots of land so that they could build the synagogue. Right? And they said, why? Because what happens everywhere else in Israel, right? People will move into their apartments. And there is no synagogue. So what do? You have a minyan in the Gan Yeladim, right? In the local, or the local gym of the high school for the next 10 years. You know, then it stretches into, then you make a building committee, it takes 15 years. Then maybe everybody's built by the time they're 25 years in their homes, they actually get a shul. They say, we don't want to be like that, right? We want to actually have a shul first. In fact, the shul was put up before any of the houses. Quite a feat, because they'd basically taken, I think it was like $20,000 from every single resident before they even went in. And that way, they got the house, they got it built. This is what people are saying. They're saying it's not yet time to build, because we've got to build, get the funds and whatever it is. And he says, wait, your priorities are skewed. If you've got a nice house, right? What about God, right? In fact, the phrase that keeps on recurring, in the English translation, it had translated differently, but I decided to translate it very literally. Simu levavchem al darkechem. Put your heart or put your hearts on your way. What does that mean? Put your heart on your way. Simu levavchem, place your hearts al darkechem, on your path. What do you think that means? I think that means examine your ways. Examine whether your priorities are correct. I'm that phrase, if you're not sure where I'm talking about, it is in number 7, and we'll see it later on as well.
Right? Number 5,
okay? In verse 5. Place your heart on your path. So The people keep on saying, it's not time, it's not time. Why else are they saying that? Look at verse 10. Well, you know, I'm going to read it together with you, verse 9. Panel harbev hine lema'at. You've been expecting so much, and you're getting very little. And what you brought it when you brought it home, I would blow on it because of what, says the Lord? Because of my house, which lies in ruins, while you all hurry to your own houses. That is why the skies above you have withheld their moisture, and the earth has withheld its yield. And I have summoned fierce heat upon the land, upon the hills, upon the new grain, and the wine, and the oil, upon all the ground produces, upon man and beast, upon all the fruits of labor. What are they saying? What's happening in the country? They have a drought. The economy is terrible, right? You thought you'd come back and you heard all these nostalgic people were waxing nostalgic about the fruitful and bountiful land of Israel, and you come here and your panal, it's all gone upside down. And he says, you think, look, if the economy's so bad, that means God's not with us. So God obviously isn't smiling at us, and therefore we shouldn't build a house. But what's God saying? You know why I'm making the economy bad? Because you didn't build it. You misunderstood. I was saying to you, get your priorities straight. You didn't get the message. Now I'm telling you explicitly. I'm making life hard because you decided to go and set up your own farm and your own businesses before you cared about me. So I said, you know, if your business fails, you'll realize you'll get the message. You didn't get the message. You said, oh, my business failed. God's not with us. If God's not with us, we shouldn't build the temple. He doesn't want a temple either. He doesn't want us here at all. It's remarkable, right? And this is what's happening here. That God's saying, and by the way, what does he tell them in the end to do, right? By the way, this idea that the economy's bad, you can also see in verse 6. You've sowed much and brought in little. You eat without being satisfied. You drink without getting your fill. You clothe yourself, but no one gets worn. And he who earns anything earns it with a leaky purse, right? Okay? You know that feeling when you thought, just yesterday I took 500 shekel out of the kaskomat, yeah? And why have I only got 200 shekel in my wallet today? Doesn't make sense. That's how everybody's feeling, right? You know? And the economy's just not working. And he tells them, right, don't do this. Verse 8. Go to the hills, get timber, rebuild the house. And then I'll look at it with favor and I'll be glorified, said the Lord. I'll put it this way. They're waiting for God. God says, I'm waiting for you, right? I'm waiting for you. Right? Or as I called it before, if you build it, right? Right? I will come, right? Sort of thing, right? I'm waiting for you. You came back, right? Nobody said it's going to be grand. It's going to be a long time. But first of all, your expectations were way high, and this has been less high than you thought, right? And therefore, you're disappointed. The economy is wrong. You're waiting for me. I'm waiting for you. Yes?
Was there any stream of, similar to, say, 18th century Europe that you ran away from Mashiach from, that you couldn't go and build a temple and force God's
hand? Trying to think whether that is explicitly, right? But I imagine there is. In other words, I'm sure there were, and it's very interesting that you have this prophet of Haggai and Zechariah, we're going to see in a second, who are actually going to try, and we're going to look at, back at it into the book in a minute, who are going to try and really give the spiritual boost, right? When a prophet comes to you, it's difficult to argue with him, but it seems like at this point they've been in the absence of prophets, and people just aren't building up the wherewithal, the emotional energy, the spiritual. They don't feel God's with them enough to really feel that they can take this leap. So maybe, yes, there are people saying, we've got to wait for Mashiach. Something like that. Yes?
Could it also be that some of these people that are coming back have never experienced what they're supposed to be experiencing because they were born in exile and are like a second... 100%,
right? I do gain the sense, you gain it through Haggai and other places as well, that people are very disappointed, right? And I'd say life is financially hard here in the land of Israel. And it could well be that they're looking back to Bavel, where living is a little easier, and wondering why the heck we came. Right? It's very interesting in the book of Zechariah, when they actually start building, the people from Bavel come around and the structure's up, but it's not yet functioning. And they send a message back to Judah, and they say, can we stop fasting on Tisha B'Av? In other words... That's what's bothering the diaspora jury, right? That's what the people in Babel. Should we fast or should we not fast? But they're actually struggling with the day-to-day balancing their own economic needs with trying to build up the vision to get this project going, and we'll see against a lot of resistance in a few minutes. Yes?
There's also this real lack of leadership. Shlomo, this was key thing, and he took the initiative. There's no sort of one person up there.
Beautiful.
Leading, but
he did it through forced labor. Maybe if they had let it voluntary, the same thing would have happened.
But he did it at the same time as he built his own house. You know, they were.
I hear you. So you're saying, I'm not even going to answer that question. I'm just going to say there definitely is a question of leadership. Okay, and the two leaders who are mentioned here, you'll see in verse 12, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and the high priest Yoshua, the son of Yehotzadak. Okay, Jamie said before, is that Zerubbabel, the Zerubbabel from Maosor? He is the Zerubbabel from Maosor. In Maosor, one of the verses says, Kates Babel, Zerubbabel. The end of Babylon was Zerubbabel. Because once they finished, they came out of Babylon. Zerubbabel, Lekates Shivim Noshati. At the end of 70 years, I was saved. So the Zerubbabel is like the political leader, and the religious leader is Yehoshua, right? The high priest. By the way, I just want to say how this story is one of the few stories in the Bible that has a happy end, okay? Because if you look at verse 12, look what happens. I mean, us Jews, we don't listen to our prophets, okay? Prophets say things and we ignore them, usually, right? We do exactly the opposite. But look at this. This is amazing. Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the high priest, and all the rest of the people gave heed to the summons of the Lord of God and to the words of the prophet Haggai when their Lord God sent them. The people feared the Lord, and Haggai, the Lord's messenger, fulfilling the Lord's mission, said to the people, I am with you, declares the Lord. And what did they do? Then the Lord roused the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and the spirit of the high priest Joshua, and the spirit of all the people. They came and set work to the house of the Lord, their host, their God, on the 24th of the sixth month in the second year of King Darius. This is when they start building the temple. Notice, the prophet came on the first of the sixth month. Within 4 weeks, right? 2-3.5 weeks, they already started working at it. Something that Haggai did managed to fire up people to really realize this is time to embark on this project. We've let sort of like, you know, really sitting there for 15 years or so, and they get on with it. Okay? Now, it wasn't only Haggai. If you look at source number two here, you look at the book of Zechariah. And this is a famous haftarah. We read it several times here. It's the haftarah on Hanukkah. Okay? It's also the haftarah, when we look at chapter 4, which is going to provide the crest for Medinat Yisrael, of a menorah surrounded by olive branches. Okay? But I just want to give you an example. You asked about people waiting for Mashiach, right? I just want to read this, this again, amazing image. Zechariah is prophesying also in the second year of Darius, exactly the same time. Haggai and Zechariah. We'll see it in a minute in the book. I'll just read here. He further showed me Joshua. This is an image of Zechariah. Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and the accuser standing at his right to accuse him. So you've got, if you can imagine, a courtroom maybe, right? And Joshua the high priest is standing there, and there is the accusing attorney, right? The prosecutor. And by the way, in the Hebrew, the word is the Satan. We don't have Satan in the Christian sense as a sort of antichrist. But Satan, you have the accuser and the defender, right? And the Satan is there to always, you know, all of us have good sides and we have bad sides. The Satan is always bringing up the bad sides of us. And then some other, so Satan is up there standing and we're going to tell us everything that's wrong with Joshua. Joshua is a symbol of the Jewish people. Now look what happens. The angel of the Lord said to the accuser, the Lord rebuke you, O accuser. May the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. For this is a brand plucked from the fire. The word here is used rebuke, but in Hebrew, yigar asher b'chasam means almost like to yell at somebody, to rage at somebody. In other words, Hashem, God, turns to the accuser and says, you be quiet. I don't want to hear a word out of your mouth. You are not going to accuse Joshua today. You know why? Because he is a brand plucked from the fire. An ud mutzal me'esh. What does that mean?
He's a remnant.
He's a remnant. There's been this inferno, and I've got something that I managed to pick out. The house went on fire, but I managed to steal one heirloom, one thing, right?
What's that a metaphor for? The Jewish people. Jewish people have been through destruction and exile and dispersion, and now some of them are back. They're a small remnant. And I know they're not perfect, but I don't want to hear anything negative about it. Right? Now, time to shut up, accuser. I am now giving them a new lease on life. And look how he expresses it. So, now Joshua's black, clothed in filthy garments when he stood before the angel. The latter spoke up unto his attendants, says, take the filthy garments off him. And he said, see, I've removed the guilt from you, and you shall be clothed in priestly robes. What's happening here? Joshua's wearing filthy clothes. His priestly garments are filthy. What is the dirt? What is the filth? When he gives him new clothes, he says, I've removed your guilt from you. So the stains on his clothing are the stains of?
Israel, the
sin. Of sin, right? And what does he say? I'm giving you new clothing. In other words, what's he saying? We are having a new beginning. I don't want to hear about the past. We're starting again. We're starting again. Now, if you have a prophet, right, who comes to you, and the people are feeling miserable about their situation, people are feeling, we're poor, and it's not working. And actually, one of the things they say in Eicha is, Avotenu chatu ve'einam v'anachu sovlim et avonam. Our fathers sinned and they are no more, but we are carrying their sin. They feel they have a huge hunchback of sin weighing them down. They can't move forward. What does the Zechariah come and tell them? We can start all over. You can have new clothes, white clothes. We're wiping the slate clean, right? I am getting rid of your overdraft, right? It's all gone. It's an amazing message. He is pumping the people and saying, we can do it, okay? We can do it. It's okay. The past is the past. This is a new beginning. Right? I want to give you the third image just to see how they're doing this. Right? The third image is, if you look at chapter 4, what do you see? He said, I'm looking at chapter 4, verse, it's in the third line here. I see a lamp, a menorah, all gold with a bowl over it, and the lamps on it are seven in number. The lamps have seven pipes, and by the two olive leaves, one on the right of the bowl and one on the left. It's not clear what's happening, but it seems like there are olive trees on either side of the menorah. Now, to get from olives to the menorah, to oil, is very, very hard. Okay? You ever worked with olives? In fact, there's another lovely Gemara which says that olives are like the Jewish people. Because to get oil, I always learned the story of Hanukkah, that you have to squeeze the olives and the first drop come out is oil. Mm-hmm. And then I have an olive tree in my garden. I was very excited to get olive oil, so I try to squeeze it.
It's a squishy mess.
Nothing comes out. Nothing comes out. You have to let the olives come off the tree. Then you have to let them sit and basically, you know, sit for about a month. Then you don't get oil out very easily. You have to grind them and smash them. And that's why the Talmud says, you want to get anything out of the Jews? You have to let them sit and wait. You have to grind them, smash them, put weights on their back. Maybe you'll get some oil out of them, right? What's happening here? You've got olive trees, a menorah, and it's like the olive trees are funneling, pumping oil into the menorah, pumping it out, pumping it. What's the message? To the last line of this page. Not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, said the Lord of hosts. A lot of people interpret, lo b'chayil, v'lo b'koach, kim bruchi amar Hashem. In other words, you're not going to need to work so hard, it's all going to happen. Just do it. Just do it. This dynamic duo of Haggai and Zechariah, all prophesying in the second year of Darius, managed to get this project on track. And I'll just go back to the PowerPoint for a minute. Show you. Sorry. Okay, we'll just look at this. Ezra chapter 5. The prophets Haggai and prophet Zechariah prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem, inspired by the God of Israel. Thereupon, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, the political leader, and Yeshua, son of Yotzagat, began rebuilding the house of God in Jerusalem with the full support of the prophets of God. And the house was finished in the third of the month of Adar, in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. It took them 4 years to build, but they managed to build. Okay? Where did they get the wherewithal? It came from these two prophets. Okay? In fact, if you look on the handout here, and just turn over the page to page 3 here, I put. It says here, just the last line of this passage, does anyone scorn a day of small beginnings? Right?
Mi baz liyom ktanot. In other words, you're saying, this is just miserable. No! Don't scorn small beginnings. At a small beginning, something big can happen. Right? Don't worry. The olive oil is going to come out of the trees and go into the menorah and light the flame. It's going to be okay. You're going to get new clothing. It's going to be all right. Okay? So I'm saying, being pushed with these two different ideological messages. By the way, Haggai is very interesting as Chari. Chari is about it all happening by itself. And Haggai is about, just build it, just do it. They have different messages, but the combination of the two managed to get the project on its way. So that's what we have here. Any questions? Okay. So this was the first question, was, should we even come? The second one is, can we build it? Right? Can we build it? I just want to take a step here. How are we doing with time? I just want to take a step back into our Zionism. I'm sorry I keep on giving the contemporary, but I can't resist it. One of the most famous, I put on here, and you might be wondering what it's doing here, a poem, probably one of the famous, most famous poems by Natan Altman. And this is a poem which was recited in Israel every single year on Memorial Day, on Yom HaZikaron. It's called The Silver Platter. It's one of the most famous Zionist poems. It comes from a statement by Chaim Weizmann, first president, who said, right, the state of Israel will not be given to us on a silver platter. Okay?
That verse is in the Independence Hall on the wall.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So, and we're not going to have time to, I'll leave it to Rachel Korazim or somebody else to teach you the poem properly, right? But I just want to, I've given it to you, you've got the sheets, you can look at it in your. The image here is, it's very much written, or he tried to write it in a sort of biblical style, almost if the people are waiting at the foot of a sort of Mount Sinai for their state to come. And they're waiting there. He talks about, if I look in the second stanza, right? He says, ready for the ceremony, she will rise in the moonlight, standing straight before the day, enrobed in terror and joy, right? And then a young woman and a young man emerge. Slowly, very slowly, they stride towards the nation, dressed in battle gear. Dirty, shoes heavy. They ascend the path, striding in silence. They have not changed their clothing, not washed with water. You remember in Mount Sinai, they said that everybody should wash themselves before Mount Sinai. The trace of the backbreaking day and the night of fire on the front line, endlessly fatigued, forsworn of rest and yet dripping with the dew of Hebrew youth. Like statues they approach, they stand motionless. No sign whether they are alive or dead. And then a nation in tears and rapture. By the way, again, like the returnees, crying and rejoicing, say, who are you? And the two will then answer with soft voice, we are the silver platter on which the Jewish state was given to you. Fascinating about this is Natan Altman is writing this, even before independence, by the way. And he's saying, if we're going to get a state, it's going to be based on our youth, who are going to fight on the front lines and work in the fields by day. And they're going to come, and they're going to come in blood-stained clothing and exhausted. They're going to fall down, as the last line says. So they spoke and fell down at the feet cloaked in his shadow. Right? You don't know whether they really are just exhausted because they've worked so hard, or they really have been shot. What will be the price, he's wondering. But Natan Altman said that to build a Jewish state, there's going to be a big price. And we're going to get dirty. We're going to get dirty. And you can say that in any dimension, simply because of the number of losses of people, young and old. Maybe I'll even say morally. To run a country doesn't mean to remain in this purest place. You're going to make mistakes and whatever it is. Every year when I talk to my students before Yom HaTzmaut and Yom HaZikaron, I bring them the chapter from Zechariah and I bring them Magash HaKesed. I say, we all hope, right, that we will have the image of Zechariah and we'll get those clean clothes. And Mashiach will be able to come and it'll all be simple. The temple will come down from heaven, the Messiah will come, and all our problems will go away. The reality is more like Magash HaKesed, right? And yet, we all need a little of the ideology of the Mashiach. You know, even Ben-Gurion spoke about the state of Israel in messianic terms, because if we don't hope that we will be able to create this unbelievable future, we won't do it. That's what Zechariah does. He manages to be able to give people a hope that their future will be new, their future will be fresh, and it is this energy with which they build the temple. Okay, so that's relating to our second challenge, okay, if you build it. Okay, I think we have to move on to political troubles and other sects. We said there were three other challenges, and here I want to get into these while we still have time together. So I want you to turn back to the pages of Ezra. And I want to just read one of the letters and show you something a little strange. One of the things that the book of Ezra is going to do is it's not going to be very easy to read historically. Sometimes what it does is it sort of collapses all different historical events and puts them in the same chapter, even though they're in completely different periods. I remember I had to read through chapter 4 and 5 and 6 about 10 times before I understood what the heck was going on there. It's a very, very complicated series. Why? Well, let me explain. You know what? I'm just going to read from chapter 4, right? It says like this. You with me in chapter 4?
Yeah.
When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord God of Israel, they approached. Now, who are these adversaries of Judah and Benjamin? Who are they? Great question. We have some enemies. We're going to see their names in a few minutes. They approached Zerubbabel and the chiefs of the clans and said to them, "Let us build with you, since we too worship your God, having offered sacrifice since the time that King Asarhadon of Assyria brought us here." Aha. These people were brought here by the Assyrians. We call these people, anyone? Samaritans. Why do we call them Samaritans? Because they were brought from afar to Samaria. We call them Samaritans. Okay, we're going to talk about them in a couple of minutes and understand. And what do they want to do? What do they ask to do in chapter 2? They see the Jews building the temple, and what do they say?
We want to help.
We worship the same God as you. Zerubbabel, Yeshua, and the rest of the chiefs of the clans of Israel answered them, "It is not for you and us to build a house to the Lord, but we alone will bid it to the Lord God of Israel in accordance with the charge that the king, King Cyrus of Persia, has laid us." In other words, the returnees reject the Samaritans. Why do you think they reject the Samaritans? It's a good question. We'll see in a few minutes. Okay? Now, you're going to hear. What's their response? When they get rejected, what do? Thereupon the people of the land undermined the resolve of the people of Judah and made them afraid to build. They bribed ministers in order to thwart their plans all the years of King Cyrus, king number one, until the reign of King Darius. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, at the start of his reign, they drew up an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the time of Artaxerxes, somebody called Bishlam, Mitredat, and Tabael, and the rest of their colleagues wrote to King Artaxerxes of Persia a letter written in Aramaic and translated. And now, by the way, the book of Ezra changes from Hebrew to Aramaic, and we have a quote of the letter. This is an amazing historical document, because, you know, let's just read a few. Now, I just want you to understand. The book of Ezra is talking about what happens in the time of Cyrus and Darius, right, to build the temple. Suddenly it's going to flash forward another 60 years to another anti-Semitic campaign which took place in the time of Artaxerxes, in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And an anti-Semitic letter was written then. And it quotes it verbatim, right? I'll just follow it through to verse 11. The last line of the page. Can you see it there? "To King Artaxerxes from your servants, men of the province beyond the river. And now, be it known to you, the king of the Jews, to the king, that the Jews who came up from you to us have reached Jerusalem and are rebuilding the rebellious and wicked city. They're completing the walls and repairing the foundation." In other words, we skip forward to a letter which is complaining not about the building of the temple, but complaining about the rebuilding of the walls in the time of Nehemiah. Now, the book of Ezra and Nehemiah doesn't care. It's all the same anti-Semites, and they're stopping us doing what we want to do, right? And look what they say. "Now be known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls completed, they will not pay tribute or poll tax or land tax, and in the end it will harm the kingdom. Now, since we eat the salt of the palace, and it's not right we should see the king dishonored, we've written to advise the king of this, so you may search in the records of your fathers, and find in the records will know that the city is a rebellious city, harmful to kings and states. Sedition has been rife in it from early times. On this account, the city was destroyed. We advise the king that if the city is rebuilt and the walls are completed, you will no longer have any portion in the province beyond the river. In other words, they're rebuilding their walls. Why would they want walls? Because they want to rebel, right? And this is this letter which was sent. Okay. Now, this is the exact text of the letter from the time of Artaxerxes. And probably they have the copy because this is written close to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. They could actually keep the document. But then, suddenly, right, we're going to come back in chapter 5 to a similar story which happened when they were building the temple, right? And then they're going to actually have King Darius digging out of the archives the original documents of Cyrus, and we see the way he says, no, I agreed to build a temple, I agreed to pay for it, and all of that. So what they're essentially doing is telescoping all sorts of appeals to central government, to the big emperor, about, but it's amazing to see these documents and the things they would say about Jerusalem, right? Phenomenal, right? To see them, and then you see the way, you know, they're using all of the classic things. They're going to rebel against you. They're not going to pay taxes. They've always, look into your history books, they've always been a seditious city, right? And what's amazing is then they, if you follow through, we don't have the time to do it, but essentially they go back and they tell the king, check your records, and they pull out all the documents. By the way, the Babylonians and before them the Assyrians had immaculate records, right? And the example of that is the Cyrus cylinder, right? And they pull out the records and they say, no, this is all legit. It's all been signed off. Everything's okay. And they allow them to do it. Now, I just want to talk about who this group is, because we need to understand who they are. So if you turn to, on the handouts that I just gave you, to source number 6. On page 6. Not in the book, in the handout that I gave you today. Source number 6. I just want to explain who the Samaritans are and what they're about. Okay. Just to understand a little bit about the map. Okay. The Jews returned back to this area. Here's Jerusalem and an area around it. Okay? Just to understand, if you want to orient yourself, on this side, okay, we have Zanoach, Azekah. This is around the area of Tzorah. Bet Shemesh is around here. So this is the sort of the line of Bet Shemesh over here. In the south, you have, this is Hebron. So the bottom of the kingdom is just between Gush Etzion and Hebron. They didn't have any control below here. North of Jerusalem, north of Bet El, if that means anything to people, a little north of Jericho, a very small province they had here. Right, this is the land. Who was around them? Okay, in the north, on my map it's there, I don't know why it didn't come out, is Samaria. The capital of the Samaria is not Samaria, it's actually going to be Shechem, Nablus, right? Shechem in the north, and the Samaritans have taken over this whole area. Okay, over here you have the kingdom of Ashdod with the Philistines. Over here you have the Edomians, okay, who used to be down here below the Dead Sea, but once we vacated our land, they pushed all the way up to this very fertile land. Okay, and here you have Moab and Ammon. Okay, we're going to meet all of these kingdoms in a few minutes. Now, nobody wants to see the Jews here. Because if the Jews aren't here, there's more land for everybody else. And the Jews feel that they're entitled to this area. And if they're settling this area in such an intense way, everybody's getting nervous, right? What are they going to do to us? And therefore, every time, the largest group here are the Samaritans. Now, just to explain where the Samaritans come from and the struggle which is going to happen against them. Let's just look at source number 6. This is happening, just to give you a timeline, okay? This is happening about 150 years before the destruction of the first temple. If you want an exact year, we're talking about 720 BCE, the fall of Samaria and the loss of the 10 tribes. The 10 tribes are taken out of Samaria and spread around. That's why they got lost, because they weren't kept as a group, like the Babylonians let them stay as a group. They spread them about. They lost their identity because they were dispersed. Instead, look what happens. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, from Kuta, from Ava, from Hamat, and Sapharvaim, and he settled them in the towns of Samaria in the place of the Israelites. They took possession of Samaria and dwell in its town. So we've got these foreign groups who are not Jewish come to the land of Israel. When they first settled there, they didn't worship the Lord. So the Lord sent lions against them, which killed some of them. So what happens? There's a plague of lions. How do they interpret this? They say to the king of Assyria, the nations you deported and resettled in the town of Samaria did not know the rules of God of the land, therefore he's let lions loose against them, which are killing them, for they don't know the rules of the God of the land. So why do we have a plague of lions? Because they're not worshipping the God of the land. In other words, you bring other people from other lands, they worship the gods of Babylon, but they're not worshipping the gods of Samaria. So that's why we're all getting killed. The king of Assyria gave an order, said, one of the priests who you've deported, let him dwell there, and let him teach the practice of the God of the land. So one of the priests whom they exiled from the Samaria came and settled in Bethel. He taught them how to worship the Lord. But look at this. They worship the Lord while serving their own gods, according to the practices of the nations from which they'd been deported. In other words, are these guys Jewish or are they not Jewish?
No.
They're not Jewish, but they get this plague as a result of which one of the priests of Bethel teaches them how to serve God. They serve God and other gods, right? They serve our God and their gods. They're a bit of this and a bit of that, right? The way it's told in a Midrash, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, I'll just read it with you. This is a fascinating source. When the Israelites were exiled from Samaria to Babylon, the king sent his servants and caused them to dwell in Samaria and to raise tribute for his kingdom. What did the Holy One blessed do who he sent lions among them which killed some of them? They sent to the king saying, O Lord, the king, the land where you've sent us will not receive us. We're left but few out of many. The king sent and called for the elders of Israel and said to him, all those years when you were in the land, the beasts of the field didn't breathe you, and now it will not receive my servants. They gave a word of advice. Perhaps he would restore them to their land. They said, O Lord, O king, the land does not receive a nation who does not study Torah. Behold, the land does not receive a nation who were not circumcised. In other words, this is a Midrash, but it's a great Midrash. The Midrash says, the Jews thought, wait, this is our chance to get back. They turned to the king and said, to be in the land, you have to be circumcised. Right? The king said, go give me two of you who shall go and circumcise them all and teach them in the book of the Torah. There's no refusal in the word of the king. In other words, I'm not bringing you back. We're going to force all of those new people to be circumcised. Right? They sent Rav Dostai of the courthouse and Rabbi Michayahu, and they circumcised them. They taught them the book of the Torah in the notary conscript, in other words, not in the script that the Jews used. The Jews had one alphabet, and the Samaritans had a different one. And they wept. Why did they weep? Because they were making them look like Jews, but they weren't really Jews. Okay? And now, these nations follow the statutes of the Torah. They served also their own gods. I want you to understand, the Samaritans are people who have Jewish practices. They write in Hebrew. They relate to the Bible. If you ask the Samaritans themselves, they will say, we are descended from the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And they claim that they're Jews. And that's why they say, we want to build the temple with you. But the other Jews don't see them as Jews. Ive, this is a recipe for disaster. Okay? There was strife between the Jews and the Samaritans throughout Second Temple period. The Talmud says things went in fluctuations. There were times when something the Samaritans did keep, you could trust them. You could even trust their blessings. You could trust other things. But eventually, they totally separated from the Jewish people. What happens in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah? I'm going to read it here because we are short of time. Look at what it says here. When Ezra came up with Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, son of Jehozadak, they began to build the temple of the Lord, and the Samaritans came against them to fight with 180,000 men. Okay? Were they Samaritans? Were they not Cuthians? But they were called Samaritans because of the city of Samaria. And further, they sought to kill Nehemiah. As it says, come let us meet in one of the villages. But they thought to do me mischief. The rest of this Midrashic text says that what did Ezra and Nehemiah do? They excommunicated them. They pronounced them as being non-Jews. And this is exactly the drama which underlies the whole of the book of Nehemiah. I'm going to ask you in a moment to look at Nehemiah, and that'll be our last text, but I just want to explain. This is going to underline, number one, the political problem, and number two, the intermarriage. You've just read the text from Malachim, from Kings, that they weren't really Jews and they were forcibly converted and all of that. But I'll ask you, right? If they sort of walk like the Jews and act, even if you go to the Samaritans now, right? They have a mezuzah. They do it differently from us, but they have a mezuzah. They have a Sefer Torah. It's different from ours, but they have a Sefer Torah, right? If you were living in the land of Israel that time, and you've got a very small, beleaguered Jewish community, and you were looking for a nice shidduch, right? Or you were, you know, you were just interested in spreading further afield, and there are lots of country, lots of lands with, you know, a lot of Jewish history. Would it seem so bad to marry a Samaritan girl? She also worships God, right? To marry a Samaritan boy? The high priest's family were married to Samaritans. People didn't see the big difference. They weren't so educated. They didn't see the difference. And now maybe you understand when the Samaritans saw all of these new groups. First, the group who first came from Persia. And then the new influx of people in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah coming along and building their walls. What did they say? They're pushing us out. We have a nice group of everybody sort of together. We're all sort of Semitic, right? It works, right? These people are coming back and they're much more separatist. They're clamping down on intermarriage. We don't like this. So therefore, at the beginning, the Samaritans, who were sort of quasi-Jewish, the Jews who came back also weren't so, you know, I don't know, devout in their Jewish identity. Let's all be together. Suddenly you get these Ezra, who comes back and he's the priest of the law, and he's saying, no, a Jew is a Jew and a Samaritan is not a Jew. There were many Jews who didn't like this. They were all married to those tribes. They thought it was 100% kosher, right? And they didn't like this idea that the Jews were now building their own city and becoming separatists. How does this play out? If you look in your biblical text and look at the story of Nehemiah, I just want to show you a couple of fascinating passages. So take a look. At the beginning of your booklet, you should have the book of Nehemiah. You've got it? You have it there?
Yes, 1820.
So, I just want you to look at chapter 4. I will tell you this. The walls hadn't been built for 80 years. I told you Nehemiah was pretty much a doer. Mm-hmm. Nehemiah put those walls up in 52 days. Mm-hmm. 52 days. Okay, it's absolutely remarkable. Okay, he arrives on Rosh Chodesh Av. He spends 3 days recuperating from his trip. He gets up on the third Av and he says, come on, we're going to build. You know what he does? It's amazing. He gets different people. He demands that everybody come to Jerusalem. People from Jericho, right? They build a bit of the wall on this side of Jerusalem. People from the north build it on this side, and this side, and this side. He gets all the different guilds. You know, the Haberdashers Guild and the Metal Workers Guild. They all build. Everybody says, you build 20 yards of the wall, and you build the next 20 yards, and you build the next 20 yards. And he gets everybody involved, right? And the walls start going up, right? Remember, once the walls are up, you can defend yourself. You can close the gates. You're defendable. Suddenly, chapter 4, when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, Sanballat is a Samaritan. Tobiah is an Ammonite. It's all everybody. The Ammonites here. The Samaritans here. I don't know who the Aravim are. The Ashdodites here. The Edomites here, right? That the healing had come to the walls of Jerusalem, the breach parts had become to be filled and angered them very much. They all conspired to come together to fight against Jerusalem and to throw it into confusion. Because of them we prayed to God and set up a watch over them. Judah was saying, the strength of the basket carriers failed, and there's so much rubble we're not able to ourselves to rebuild the walls. And our foes were saying, before you see it, we shall be in amongst them and kill them and put a stop to the work. So, what does he say? Look at verse 7. I stationed on the lower levels of the place, behind the walls, on the bare rock. I stationed the people by families with their swords, their lances, and their bows. In other words, he's got people building, behind them, their families. And then I decided to exhort the noble prefects and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Think of the great and awesome Lord and fight for your brothers, your sons and daughters, your wives and homes. He does an amazing thing. He's got the men building, behind them, their children and wives are carrying weapons. Now, it's a double effect. Number one, they're feeling protected. Number two, they're going to defend their women and children. right? And in the meantime, he's walking around the walls giving them pep talks, you know, and all of that. When our enemies learn and they become known to us since God that has frustrated their plan, we could all return to the wall, each to his work. From that day on, half my servants did work, and half held lances and shield, bows and armors. Right? If you look at verse 12, as for the builders, each had his sword girded at his side as he was building. The trumpeter stood beside me, right? He had a trumpeter, and I said to the nobles, the prefect, and the rest of the people, there is much work, and it's spread out. We're scattered over the wall, far from one another. When you hear a trumpet call, gather yourselves at me at that place. Our God will fight for us. And so we worked on, while half of us were holding lances from the break of day until the stars appeared. By the way, this chapter is the inspiration for the symbol of the Nachal Brigade, which has the idea of a spear and a scythe, the idea of working and defending at the same time. This chapter was the inspiration for the Nachal, so we're kibbutznikim, but also, but what's the idea here? Again, he's got a trumpet, right? Whenever there's attack, sound the trumpet, right? Everybody come there to defend. They're building, they're defending, they've got a public address system, right? It then ratchets up another level in chapter 6, right? We're going to see the same group try to assassinate Nehemiah. They have him go to a prophet one day, and the prophet says, people are trying to kill you. You know what we need to do? I need to meet with you tonight, alone, in the temple, and we'll close the doors and have a private chat. And Nehemiah goes, I know you're lying, and I know this is a plot. It's amazing, they were going to assassinate Nehemiah in the temple. Couldn't get better than that. Nobody could write this story better than that. What a great place, right? A prophet is paid off by the enemy to get him to say, we need to have a chat very late tonight in the temple, and we've got to close the doors, right? And he says, no, I know what you're up to, and all of that. So this is one side of the story, that once the Jews start getting that together, all the nations around him got to stop them, because we know where they're going to, you know, once they get their act together and they get their kingdom. It's happened in the time when they're building the temple, happened when they're building the walls. The flip side of this is that a lot of people there are very happy to marry the Jewish population. And that's when we get to the last bit of the book, where Ezra and Nehemiah set their final task to trying to ensure that Jews only marry Jews. And they actually have everybody, I'll go back to the, what I started off with. Let's make sure. Yeah. The plan of all the different chapters. Here we go. It starts off with, on Rosh Hashanah, they gather all the people at the temple. And Ezra reads the Torah to them. I don't know which chapters he read, it doesn't tell us. But it says the people end up in tears. And they say, don't worry, let's celebrate. They celebrate Sukkot together. But they get to signing a treaty. Now, Ezra had already tried to deal with this in chapter 10 of Ezra. But this is what happened with Ezra. I told you, Ezra was a very spiritual man, but he wasn't the greatest of administrators, because he heard that everybody was intermarried. He said, we're going to do something about it. He invites everybody to a meeting in Jerusalem in the month of Kislev, let's say December. Now, he had very, very bad luck. It says that the day that he arranged this gathering, it was pouring with rain. Right? It was pouring with rain. And he says everybody was shivering and freezing. And they turn around to Ezra and say, Ezra, there's so much work to do. And so many people are intermarried, right? You know, this is not the work for one day. What do you do in the Knesset when you don't want to deal with something? They say, let's set up a committee. Let's set up a committee. And the committee will summon people when they have time. And they set up this committee, and nothing gets done. Okay? Nothing gets done. Well, Nehemiah's in town. Nehemiah builds the walls in 52 days. The next thing he does is he invites everybody that Rosh Hashanah to the temple, and he has them all sign a document. He makes a list of all the community, and then he tells them what they have to agree to. Okay? If you want to look at the list, it's quite something. Look at chapter 10. You've got it in front of you. You see chapter 10 there? It's on page 13. In view of this, we make a pledge and put in our writing and the sealed copy, our subscribed, our officials, our Levites, our priests. It's got a list of all the signees, right? I'm not going to make you read all of it. It's very, very, very long. But I want to show you what they say they're going to do. Look at verse 31, okay? Or even 30. Verse 30 on page 14. You with me? Join with the noble brothers and take an oath with sanction to follow the teaching of God given through Moses, the servant of God, and to observe carefully all the commandments of the Lord our Lord, his rules and laws. But namely, now he's going to specify. Verse 31, we will not give our daughters in marriage to people of the land or take their daughters for our sons. Number 2, the peoples of the land who bring their wares and all foodstuffs to sell on Shabbat day, we will not buy from them on Shabbat or on a holy day. In other words, no trade on Shabbat. Okay? We will forgo the produce of the seventh year. Again, a Shabbat related thing, but this is not just the seventh day, but the seventh year. So the first one is intermarriage. Verse 32, Shabbat and Shemitah. Number 33, we have laid upon ourselves the obligation to charge ourselves 1/3 of a shekel yearly for the service of the house of our God. Right? So, not a half shekel, but a third shekel. I don't know if the currency had changed. Okay? So they're going to actually financially support the temple. Right? And all the rest of it really relates to the temple. I'm just going to relate to one other thing in chapter 11. Look at chapter 11, verse 1. The officers of the people settled in Jerusalem. The rest of the people cast lots for 1 out of 10 to come and settle in the holy city of Jerusalem, and the other 9/10 to stay in their towns. In other words, until this point, Jerusalem being a backwater, nobody wanted to live there. Okay? Everybody wanted to live in their farms. Nehemiah just set up the walls. He says, but I don't have people to live in Jerusalem. He tells every clan, you must provide 1 out of every 10 people to come and reside in Jerusalem. A people tax. You've got to live in Jerusalem. And then the whole next chapter is a list of all the people who go to move to Jerusalem. He repopulates Jerusalem by force of law. Nehemiah is a wild man, right? But he gets things done. And he has people sign off on this. So when people break the law, he will take them to task for it. Okay? In other words, we see this real belt tightening in terms of what Judaism means. And really drawing lines in the sand. People who support, who keep Shabbat, who inmarry, who support the temple, who live in Jerusalem are Jews, the rest of you are not. How Judaism would have looked had Ezra and Nehemiah not walked on the scene? We really don't know. Ezra is described by the rabbis, he's called in the book of Ezra, the person who was a sofer mahir b'Torah Hashem, an expert scribe. Ezra is a person who, according to rabbinic understanding, and you're going to have classes about it, so I'm not going into detail, rehabilitated the whole area of Jewish law. So what I've tried to do in this 2 hours, sorry if it was a little bit hard going, right? But to try and cover something like, what is it here? 23 chapters in a short session. But I really tried to give, also a couple of things, a bit of Chagai and Zechariah, is trying to give you an overview to what the achievements were of these people, the different temperaments between Ezra and Nehemiah, the challenges that they faced, which are so similar to many challenges in our age. Who is a Jew? Question of setting up a country, making people believe in their future, creating new narratives about what that future might be, right? The balances between diaspora and the land of Israel, because now there really are two Jewish centers, right? The questions of definition of Judaism. And, last but not least, dealing with all sorts of international trouble, right, for various developments that the new state of Judea, as it's called here, want to create. And you can also see by so many of the references that I've given you, even the crest of Israel, the modern state of Israel, comes from these things, how much this period inspired the builders of the state of Israel in much of what they were building in terms of what they were trying to build. So I hope this was meant to be an overview. I hope we've overviewed and you're a little bit oriented and that you'll feel a little more at home, not more confused, in all of the sessions you're going to have over the wonderful next few days. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.